Really, basically, I want to start with telling you how to get the most out of this. Because there is, frankly, an insane amount of information that you're going to get here. We're simply not going to cover it all. So if you are going to hope to benefit from this, you're going to have to do something with it. Okay, so when we introduced this topic some weeks ago, we said that our objective as parents is to turn out, and is not to raise children, but to produce adults. But there's a huge distinction between the two that a lot of parents spend their time focused on, quote, raising children, when in fact the entire mission statement of a parent is to produce a mature and responsible adult. And anything short of that is, we'll say, unsuccessful. Which leads to a collection of questions, one of which is, what is an adult? Anybody want to take a guess at that? Especially if you weren't there that Friday evening?
I would say somebody that's considered to be possibly between 18 and 21 that's got some sense of responsibility about themselves and the world around.
Okay. That's a good operating definition. Anybody want to add anything to that? All right, well, we'll say an adult is not somebody who necessarily... Remember, your job is not to produce a 50-year-old, right? Hopefully your kids will be gone before you're 50. Your job is to produce someone that is ready to be what I refer to as a practicing adult. In exactly the same way as a person who has a driver's license is able to drive safely. They're considered by some testing agency to have all the requisite skills so that they can at least start the process of driving on their own. Does that mean they know everything about driving? No, as evidenced by 5 minutes behind the wheel, and you can tell that there's a lot of people that still have practicing to do, right? Yes. So we know that the just having a driver's license doesn't prove that you know everything, and in the same way, our job as parents is to turn out practicing adults who won't wreck themselves or someone else as they learn better how to be fully functioning adults. So then we have to back up from that and ask a simple question. What is the collection of skills that will best equip a person to become a practicing adult? And that's what we're responsible for. That body of information that needs to be transferred from generation to generation so that when your children launch, that act of leaving the home, when your children launch, that they are ready to launch and that you haven't set them up to fail. Do we see evidence all around us of people who have been not necessarily intentionally set up to fail, but they haven't been set up to launch? Of course we do. And so there's a big gap between what parents think they should do and what they're actually responsible for. All right. So how do we do this? What are the collection of skills that we should that a child turning to an adult should understand? And here's the next thing that we said. That a lot of us as practicing adults already, who have become now practicing parents, right? And in fact, that's kind of what we are, practicing parents. By the time you've gotten a few of them out of the house, you start to understand how you should have begun the process. And that's why this is an intergenerational or a multi-generational thing, because frankly, it's as you start to look back on the things that you didn't do well and also discover some of the things that you're discovering as an adult that you get the full body of information and say, oh, if I had to do it over again, I'd probably tell them this. And as a matter of fact, I'm still discovering some things that, boy, I wish I would have known them 20 years earlier. Scott, you and I have had that conversation multiple times. Boy, I wish someone would have told me this 20 or 30 years ago. So then I asked another question. What if I could put all this together? What if we could look at intergenerational or multi-generational bodies of knowledge and say, there's got to be a collection of important things that we could comprehensively present? And so this is the first of a multi-part series. This is 6 weeks. We'll probably do another 6 weeks in the winter. And my assumption is that there's probably at least 20 different things that a practicing adult needs to know. But we simply can't cover them all at once. All right, so here's another important thing. They're connected. Have you ever noticed that you learn something and then 2 or 3 years later you hear something else and there's that aha moment? What creates ahas?
Knowledge that you, Oh, gee whiz, man. there's a new piece of info I wish I would have had.
It's a new piece of information, but what makes it an aha is that you find that it's connected to something that you already know. And all of a sudden, what you did know makes more sense when you find out the new piece of information. It's like, oh, now everything that they've been saying makes sense. Have you ever heard some old proverb, for instance? I don't mean necessarily a biblical proverb or some cliche. And you might have even used it for years, and you're not really sure why you used it, but it just sounded intelligent to use, and everybody nodded their heads whenever you did, so it worked. And then one day, there is that aha moment where it's like, oh, that's what that means. Here, I thought it meant this other thing over here, but it's like, oh, well, it makes a lot of sense when I say it like that now. Our job is to try to connect the pieces of information that our kids get. Okay, so how to get the most out of this? Come prepared to take notes. There's a video that accompanies each of these. I decided that I'm not going to every week show you a video of me shooting a video because that would really be stupid. And then I'd have to get up after that and talk about what I just said. So I'm not going to show you the video. But every week you're going to get an email reminder. And if you want to watch the video, there's a few things there that aren't covered specifically in what we're going to do. There's a lot more than we're going to cover here. Take time to read through the handout that you get. Here's another big one. There's going to be a simple key idea each week. This week, it's we were made for relationships, and I'll unpack that a little bit more. We were made for relationships. So in one way or another, I want you to remember that. I want you to remember it in such a way that you're going to be able to start to share that with your kids, or maybe even it's going to be a good reminder for yourself. Because here's what I believe. Some of you are going to have aha moments here. Like when you start to see how this stuff fits together, there's going to be some aha moments for you. Because even in the past year, as I was building up towards this, I discovered some things that, as I said on that Friday night, there were some things that my parents did really well. They shared massive amounts of information with me about certain things. And there were other areas of life where it's like I realized, and I didn't realize it until years later, because I didn't know that I didn't know, but once I knew that I didn't know, then I asked myself the question, why in the world didn't they talk about that? Boy, it would have been good if they would have had some information for me about that. We're not going to cover it in this first six-week segment, but one of the things that I wish they would have talked a little bit more about would have been how to go about looking for and finding a good mate for life. Right? That would have been something. Wouldn't you think that every parent would talk about that? These are the things that you should look for. This is the process that you should go for when you're exploring that who you're going to pick for that one person that hopefully you're going to spend the rest of your life with. Wow, that's important stuff. Why didn't my parents talk about that? I don't know. Maybe they felt under-equipped. Maybe they thought everybody just figured it out by themselves. I don't know. But now here I am, 60 years old, and I figure, you know what? Every launching young adult should know that stuff. So that's another one of those things that we'll look at, only not in week one. All right. There's some scriptures. At least have one or two of these that you memorize. You don't necessarily need to know where they came from. You don't need to know the precise wording in some certain translation. But I want you to be able to have the key idea memorized, just so that you can carry it around with you. Refer to it later. There's a worksheet. I handed out the worksheet. I want you to use the worksheet. Because the worksheet talks not only about what you're learning, but it talks about what you're going to do with what you're learning. So, as a result of what you hear today, if we ever get around to actually talking about today's topic, as a result of what you hear today, you're liable to discover something and say to yourself, I need to share this with my kids, or I need to have a talk with my wife about this. Now, I know how that goes. I mean, there's probably a dozen things in the queue already that you need to have a meaningful talk with your wife or significant other about. You probably are avoiding some of those. And maybe you've avoided them for a long time. And so this thing is going to go to the back of the queue. I understand that. But at some point in time, you need to have a conversation with your spouse about that. Because I assume, is there anybody here who's raising kids and you're in two different homes and you share custody? No? Okay, so that means that if you have kids, they're in the same home or they've left the home or whatever. So you're doing this together, you need to be on the same page about that. But I think you'd also agree that it's really hard sometimes to have a conversation with your mate and come to an agreement about how to do parenting. As a matter of fact, second perhaps only to finances, raising children is often a source of conflict in the home. I know that's surprising, but it is. All right, so you want to have some conversations with your wife. While you're still here, before you leave, because here's how this works. You say, wow, that was good. I'm going to do something with it. You walk out to your car. You look at your phone. You turn on the radio. You go to your next appointment. And an hour later, everything is forgotten. And you're never going to, let me just say it, you're never going to do anything with what you just heard. Because you're either going to make a commitment while you're still in this room to do something with this, or you may not. So just make the commitment now. Go through the worksheet. Think about it. Create an action plan for each week. Okay. Let's take a look at something else about how we set this up. How do we set ourselves up for our own success in parenting our kids? So if you'd like, turn over to Proverbs, and we're going to start at the second chapter. And yeah, I would like you to actually do that. So if you have a Bible, fine. If you have a phone app, Proverbs 2. This is one of these times where if you have a phone app, you're probably going to find it quicker because we're going to move around a little bit. So how does this happen? How do we pass information from generation to generation? How did that happen in your life? How did that happen in your home?
Spoken word.
Okay, so the spoken word is very important, right?
By example also.
But certainly by example. But there are definitely times where you're going to have to plan to speak some things into your kids' lives. So let's take a look at here. This is actually, incidentally, what the early chapters in Proverbs are all about. Chapter 2, verse 1, my son, if you accept my words and store up my commandments within you, turning your ear to wisdom and applying your heart to understanding, and if you call out for insight and cry aloud for understanding, and if you look for it as for silver and search for it as for hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom, and from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. Notice how this starts. It's a father teaching his son. All right, so everything that happens after that, the father is saying, listen, this is something important. Now, I don't suggest you go home and gather your kids around you, grandfather style, perhaps with a fireplace in the background, and say, listen, my son and daughter, that won't go well for you. I can just say that. Listen, my friend, do not do that. It will not go well for you. But do you know your children right now? Just stop and think about that. Do you know your children each well enough to know how they will favorably hear something? Set yourself up for success. Will they hear something together, or should they hear it individually? Will they hear it when it's spoken intentionally and purposefully when you sit them down? Or are they more likely to absorb it when you're going about something else and you point out this principle? So there's times when you stop and you literally just call attention to something. You sit them down and you say, this is important, and while it's on my mind, I'd like to share this with you. But there's other times where you'll see an example in real life that just illustrates this so well that you can't let that opportunity go. So in the topic that we're going to look at this morning, which is relationships, there's going to be times when you see examples of both good and bad human interaction, and you might want to discreetly point that out to your children. That doesn't mean you're going to say, would you look at that messed up couple over there loud enough for them to hear it at the restaurant? That probably wouldn't go well either. But you know what I'm saying? Maybe later on, after you've left the restaurant where the dysfunctional couple was having an argument in front of 50 other people, then you'll point that out. So that's a situation where life set you up to succeed if you'll capitalize on it. But other times, you just have to make an effort to sit them down and do something. Chapter 3, same thing. My son, if you do not forget my teaching, but keep my commands in your heart, for they will prolong your life for many years and bring you prosperity. Let's read that again, because there's something really important I want you to see there. My son, do not forget my teaching, but keep my commands in your heart, for they will prolong your life for many years and bring you prosperity. What's he saying about himself there? Look at the level of confidence that's there. If you do these things, you will get this good result. That's not a, you know, if you try this, it might work for you. Is there anything in your life that you know so well that you can tell your children with confidence, you need to live in this way because I know enough examples of people who didn't live in this way and it went badly for them? There needs to be a body of knowledge that you are going to pass on to the next generation of practicing adults that you are so confident in that you can say with a certain degree of authority. I don't know what your situation or your experience is, but I could say that at least for the first 20 years of my adult life, I would very frequently look back to what my parents said and consider it. And it's not like it was the only information I evaluated, but it certainly was important. I mean, I would put it on the scale of balance and consider other information, but I always considered my parents' information. Now, why? My dad was this, like, Proverbs guy. He was the guy who would kind of sit you down, and he would tell you this kind of stuff, and he would go on about it a little bit. I mean, when I was young, I thought he really went on about it. Later on, I started to appreciate that maybe he was just trying to drive a point home, and I remember some of this stuff. This guy, here in Proverbs, he is confident that what he has to share with his sons is important. Chapter 4, listen, my sons, to a father's instruction. Pay attention and gain understanding. I give you sound learning. Do not forsake my teaching. So now what's he saying? I give you sound learning. Where did the learning come from? Well, where does most of our best learning come from?
Experience.
Yeah. How does that usually come about?
Failure.
Yeah, exactly. So let me tell you the ways in which life did not go well for me and how I would do things differently if I had to do it again. You see the degree of personal confidence that takes? Because now you're going to have to share with your children some things that are perhaps uncomfortable for you. And aren't kids like this, right? The kid will then bring it up at the most inopportune time. Well, Daddy, do you remember when you told me about how you messed this up? And there'll be 30 other people around, right? Some of whom may never have heard this story, and they'll be all too happy to hear it for the first time. So there are risks involved. He's sitting in the back there in a state of total shock. It's like... Chapter 5. Again, my son, pay attention to my wisdom. Listen well to my words of insight that you may maintain discretion and your lips may preserve knowledge. Let's read that one again. Because here's another component. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Listen well to my words of insight that you may maintain discretion and your lips may preserve knowledge. Do you see anything else there?
Sure, the son's going to pass that down.
Exactly. So know that when you are transmitting these ideas, you're not only sharing these with your sons and daughters, but the way in which they will parent later on is dependent on what you do now. In other words, you will have a 2 or 3 generation out influence and may have influence on a generation that you never personally in this life meet. Okay, and that's being addressed right here. So don't ever think that what you say or don't say doesn't matter. It's profound. Chapter 6. My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, if you have struck hands in a pledge for another, if you have been trapped by what you said, ensnared by the words of your mouth, then do this, my son, to free yourself. What do you see there?
Change.
The father already anticipates the day, just like God did when the children of Israel come out of Egypt. And he says, if a day comes when you sin in this way, then do this. If the day comes when you have strayed beyond the point that you think it is possible for you to return to God, call it to God. What the dad is already assuming is there's going to come a day when you're going to do something that you're later on going to regret and say, oh my word, I wish I hadn't done that. In other words, there's going to come a day when you don't take the advice that I've spent years of my life giving to you. And when that day comes, here's how to extract yourself from it. Now, most of us wouldn't be that bold, would we? Because we'd think we're planting in our kids' minds the idea that, okay, this is what I want you to do, but I know you're not going to do it anyway. Well, that seems almost counterintuitive to say that. But the reality is, this is being addressed right here. The dad is saying to his sons, I know you're not always going to do the right thing. So we may as well talk about an exit strategy for when you've done the wrong thing. Chapter 7, my son, keep my words and store up my commands within you. Keep my commands and you will live. Guard my teaching as the apple of your eye. Look, bind them on your fingers and write them on the tablets of your heart. One final thing. What's his point there? Find your own ways to remember this. I'm giving you the understandings. It's your responsibility to treat these seriously and figure out how you're going to carry this on in your life. Do you learn differently than the person next to you? Probably. Do you remember things differently? Sure. If you and your wife do things, she remembers one thing about a situation, you remember something else, or maybe nothing about it, whatever. But you know what I'm saying? So we're all different. So it is up to each of your kids. It's up to you to set them up to succeed by understanding how they learn best. It's up to them then even to begin to understand how they learn best. Turn over to Proverbs 22:6. Now, if you've been in the church for even a couple of years, you've heard this verse. You've heard this verse used to the point that it's annoying. Right? You've heard this verse to the point that you probably don't even believe it. Maybe your parents used it about you when you were going through a 30-year rebellious cycle. Maybe you're still in the middle of the rebellious cycle and your parents are still using it. I don't know. Train a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he will not turn from it. Okay, so we know the textbook interpretation of this. If you teach your kids the right things, sooner or later they're going to come back and always do the right things. Do we all know exceptions to that rule? Of course we do. Yes, we do. We know people who live their entire lives having strayed from whatever it is their parents taught them, and they die in that strayedness. So some people say, okay, this is just a principle. This is just a general practice, and that's true. But I want you to think about a different interpretation of this. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is older, what you have taught him, he will not be able to separate himself from. Okay, so think about in the middle of, I don't know, pick a time in your life when you were feeling especially rebellious. For some of you, it was probably 10 minutes ago. For others of you, it was, well, we've been in the room more than 10 minutes, so it's at least 20 minutes. You got that time in your mind? Maybe you were younger and your parents told you to do something and that you should live in a certain way or you should think a certain way, and you said, you know what, they're just full of and I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go my own way. So you got that image locked in your mind. Were the words of your parents still stuck in your mind while you were doing that? Were you trying to bury them? Were you trying everything you could do to shove them out of your mind so that you could go ahead with a guilt-free conscience and go ahead and do what you wanted to do? Of course you were. Because it's annoying when your parents' words are ringing in your ears. Right? What does that prove? That for as long as they live, if you have done your job well, even if they do stray, they're going to have the constant reminder all the time that they're straying. That what you've taught them has at least some merit worth considering. It doesn't mean that you're guaranteed a perfect adult child as the result of all your efforts.
So how do you do that then without annoying them? Like you just said, like if we're constantly thinking, go back to our times, and you think you're doing something wrong, and you hear your parents in the back of your head, you don't want to be that annoying person. What's the reverse? How do you relate to a child who is rebellious anyway?
Okay, so
you got a rebellious child who's saying, screw you, excuse my language.
Okay.
No matter what. And you're
if they're a rebellious child, they might say worse than that. So anyway.
So they're rebellious already, and they're in their head, which is positive, but they're still gonna do it anyway. I think that's just the world we live in, right?
It is, but what would some parents say? Well, they're just going to have to find that out on their own. Yes, it could be.
Yeah, there comes a time of tough love where you've coached, you've encouraged, you've taught as much as you possibly can. They're still going to do what they're going to do. And you have to accept, as a parent, the results of their actions as a child upon them, not you. And then you just have to swoop in after the fact and re-guide them without condemnation.
Well, here it is in chapter 6. My son, if you put up security for your neighbor, if you have struck hands in pledge for another. And here's what's being said here. Okay, this isn't... Forget the situation. Forget the fact that this guy has just put up something as security for somebody else's loan. Just take that out of the equation for a minute. Here's what the guy is saying. If the time comes when you make a mistake and do something wrong, figure out how to get yourself out of it. You don't have to stay stuck there. So a lot of people, when they look at a verse like this, they assume that it's just about that thing. Take it as a more general purpose principle that applies to a lot of things. All right. So assume your kids are going to rebel. Assume they're going to stray. Assume they're going to find out some things the hard way. But if you don't give them any guidance for how to get out of the bad stuff, right? When you send your kids out to drive, is there a spare tire in the trunk? At least if you've had any the opportunity to check the car, of course there is. Why? Because you hope they'll get a flat? No, because you want them to have some means of helping themselves once they do get a flat, if they do. Can we agree that there's a lot of things worse in life than having a flat tire? So they better have some understandings about how to get themselves out of the worst things, even if they got themselves into it.
I've seen, too, where they may go through their rebellious period, not listening to what you're saying. But later in life, when it came through this rebellious period and settled down, some of those things guide with their future life and their how they treat their children.
Absolutely.
So it goes in there.
Like, that's what they were talking about.
Yeah, you can run from it. You can run from it as fast and as hard as you want. Where do phrases like, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, come from? Is it because every kid grows up wanting to be like his parents? Of course not. That's a fate worse than death to end up like your parents. But, well, at least temporarily it is. When you're 17, there is nothing good that could come of becoming like your parents, right? But later on in life, why do people notice that? Because it's true. Yeah. Well, not in every way.
Well, no.
Well, you know, the thing is, too, to answer your question, sometimes, you know, you try to show that example, you try to teach your kids. Sometimes they need to hear that from somebody else, or the same thing that you're trying to teach them, because you have, you know, you have no credibility. What's the saying? A prophet has no standing in his own town.
In his own town, yeah.
You know, or, you know, so sometimes, and I'll give you a perfect example. I told some of these guys before, I played semi-pro ball for 3 years. I coached my son in Little League. He had a hitch in his swing. I said, Frank, you got to open up your hips. You got to do this. Like that. I went to the other coach. I said, Joe. I said, go take Frank aside and tell him. And all of a sudden, whoopee. He was changing his swing. It just like I had no credibility. And sometimes that happens with parents. If they hear it from somebody else. But if that's somebody else, if you're hanging around the right people and you have the same values and the same attitudes, they're going to see that and figure, oh, geez, you know, Glenn feels the same way. Maybe there's something to this. So sometimes that helps.
And that is a good parental tip, that you need to have some other people who share your basic outlooks on life, and that you can pass your kids off to them or pass them over to it. Yes.
The scenario revolves around the do as I say, not as I do mentality. You know, the parents say one thing, but they're doing something differently. And the children, they pick up on this. They're not dumb to the fact that what, you know, the knowledge you're providing them is not what you're living. So that double standard thing, they read right through it. And that's somewhat the barrier you need to penetrate before they start to listen to your guidance on a positive.
Walk the walk.
Yeah. Well, and we're going to talk about that when it comes to relationships, which we're going to start in just a minute. We're actually going to get into the topic for the morning soon. And I'm not going to do this every week. There's certain things that just need to be set up for background so that you have a better appreciation for why we're doing this. Okay, we're going to go over to Psalm 112. Okay, now this is a psalm, so I need to preface what we're going to read with this. That sometimes when you read the psalms, you expect that the people are going to, this is like, well, what do we sing about in church? Well, we sing about, what's the answer? Jesus. Because that's what people sing about in church. And so when you open the psalms, you kind of expect that people are going to say, well, things about God and righteousness and goodness are great. Why would you expect that? Because we're in the psalms. But what if instead we took the approach that maybe they were actually serious when they wrote this? See, sometimes we just get our fill up to here with all this religious stuff and we think, well, it's just what people say in certain settings. But instead of looking at it that way, what if instead we looked at this and said, maybe they were actually honest at that moment when they said this. So here it is. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who finds great delight in his commands. Let's stop right there and we'll read that again. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord and who finds great delight in his commands. There's a counter assumption taking place there. What is it? Well, that there's plenty of people who don't take delight in the Lord's commands. If you're blessed when you do that, seriously, this guy must be saying, oh, but there's plenty of people who don't. And so he's saying either for himself or about somebody else, there's good that comes from this. And then look at what he says right away. His children will be mighty in the land. The generations of the upright will be blessed. Wealth and riches are in his house, and his righteousness endures forever. Scott, in keeping with what you just said, it really is about a life lived in a particular way. And when we feel that when we are living that way, we're shortchanging ourselves, what's this intergenerational statement? When I live in a certain way, it's going to pass blessing on to my kids, even when I'm not aware of it. Even if in the moment it's pretty inconvenient for me to live in this way, I have to take the long-term view. It's not just about me, it is about generations yet to come. Look at this. Even in the darkness, light dawns for the upright, for the gracious and the compassionate and righteous man. Again, is it saying that your life is going to be rosy? When you look at it intently, it's not. It's saying even in the darkest of the darkest spaces in your life is going to be marked as different from everybody else's because there's going to be some ray of hope even in that darkness. For the person who's not living according to the fear of the Lord and according to His commandments, the darkness that guy gets into is going to be really dark and without hope. So think about the darkest time in your life. Did a little bit of hope go a long way in that darkness? And can you imagine if you didn't have that hope? Just that little flicker of hope. Good will come to him who is generous and who lends freely. And on it goes. I mean, these are good principles all by themselves. But what I want you to remember is, even in the way that you live your life in the home, you're setting your kids up for success. Because, exactly as we've said, they're going to learn as much. And don't make this the cheesy by watching what you do in the sappy conversations. They're going to watch the backdrop stuff. They're going to watch the stuff that you don't even know that you're doing, and they don't even know that they're watching, but they're watching. Yeah, can it? Which is why every parent who's got kids that are 10 years or older has said to themselves, where did that come from? And then a half an hour later, you're thinking, oh, I know where that came from. Right? Even the edge in the voice and the tone and maybe even one or two of the words in that, and you're shocked by what you heard. Okay. I think we're done with the introduction. What do you say we get beyond the introduction? Okay. So our main idea for the morning, we were made for relationships. Okay, so however you want to remember that, this is an important component. Your kids need to understand this. And as one of these six principles, if your children are not equipped with the knowledge and the skills that will help them to relate well to others, they're going to struggle in some way for the rest of their lives. So here's the way I put it here. Most of the important things that we do and experience in life will be done either with or for other people. From birth to death, we will depend on others even when we're not aware of this. So I started to think to myself, you know, I don't know why. Any of you like the Discovery Channel? There's some stuff on the Discovery Channel that I like. Well, for some reason, they're on this really big Alaskan kick for the last year where it's like half the shows during primetime are about something. So I get sick of the Alaska shows. But then once in a while, I'll turn one of them on, and there's these loons that live out in the middle of nowhere with next to nothing. And so for some reason, just the other night, I was thinking about this in the context of this. Well, are there people who really don't need people? But if you think about it, most of the people, even who go off to live by themselves or themselves with their family, they at least have a gun and bullets, right? Because that's a staple of the American way. So a few guns, a few bullets, and you can make your way through life. Well, where did they come from? Where did the gun and the bullets come from?
Other people.
Even when you live in the wilderness, you depend on other people. Well, smart people do, unless they want to whittle a spear out of a branch of wood. You see what I'm saying? Even when you think you've removed yourself from the influence of other people, typically you're under the influence of other people. That's how connected we are. Your children need to understand that, and once you understand that principle, what do you want to do? You want to excel at relationships. Now, I got to insert this disclaimer, if you will. Because we're not all wired to feel warm and fuzzy around other people, okay? Let's just call it the way it is. Some people are annoyingly friendly and some people are annoyingly obnoxious, okay? I'm not going to share with you which kind I am. Maybe some of you have figured that out. I'm not telling you to brainwash your kids and try to turn them into something they're not. I'm asking you to, in the context of who they are, genetically, understand that your nurture has a powerful influence on whether they're going to understand at all how to relate to other people. Here's the next component. If you're a believer, if you actually believe, i.e., that God is in some way responsible for a grand design, and that we are in some way then part of that grand design, and there's so many of us. Do you agree? Even if you go out at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's still so many of us. You just can't get away from the rest of us. There are so many of us. So it seems inevitable that if there is a God behind this, then there must be some intentional plan for us to somehow relate to each other. That's got to be part of God's design. But yet, here's the next thing that we're already aware of. Every one of you can attest to this. People will be the source of many of our greatest joys, but also our deepest hurts. Think of the deepest pains that you experience in life. Maybe some of them you carry around with you all the time. Is there a person somehow connected with that? And what about some of the greatest joys? Is there a person connected with that? I mean, even just imagine. So suppose you are the individualistic, rugged bush person from Alaska. Right, and you go off by yourself into the rugged bush, and you build a gorgeous log cabin. How you do that without axes and saws and all that, I don't know. But suppose you're really a man of the bush, and you do this. Even for 30 seconds, you'd have to admit, it would be cool to have somebody else there to share that, what you've created with, right? So even if the only reason we want other people in our lives is to admire what we've done, there is an innate hunger inside of us to just share something with other people. Have you ever sat in the back of a movie theater when something funny happens on the screen? What do people do? You know what they do? They look around for somebody else to share the laughter with. Nobody looks straight ahead at the screen when they laugh. They look for somebody else to laugh with. Where do they learn that? They don't. It's just part of who we are. All right. So now that we've established that, there are three things that a kid needs to know, that we need to know, and incidentally, some of us still haven't mastered these skills. I just want to make that clear. We're all works in progress. Three things. How to build good relationships. Some of this stuff isn't on your notes. Scott thought he was being helpful, and so he made copies of the notes for the morning, but I was devious and I strayed from the plan. So this is the part where you use the pen that you asked me for earlier and you take some notes. Okay, three key principles which a parent must know, be able to share with his kids. How to create good relationships. How to create and build up relationships. How to maintain and sustain good relationships. This is the next one. So how to create good relationships, How to maintain and sustain good relationships. Anybody have a guess as to what the third thing is going to be?
Repair.
Is that on the notes somewhere?
No.
That's it. How to mend or repair bad relationships. You need a pen. Here, I got pens. You mean you've waited this long to ask for a pen? You shouldn't be shy. Come on. You're like all the other dysfunctional men here. They didn't come prepared and they forgot to ask. It's okay. I just want you to know this is your first time here. Nobody comes here because they like me. I abuse everybody. They come here because hopefully the content is good enough to overcome how annoying I am. I'm just putting it out there, okay? The third thing, how to repair broken relationships. Stop right now. Can you think of a relationship in your life that is strained, damaged, or completely severed? How much emotional energy have you invested in that already? Even if you didn't say a word to the other person, how much of your own spirit and emotion is invested in that relationship, even if the other person doesn't know you're mad at them? Is it at times consuming? Thanks, Jason. You may be the only compassionate person in the room. Appreciate that. This is really important stuff. So here's my advice to you. When it comes to building up and making relationships, you're going to have a lot of personal advice. And if you're not that person, then maybe, remember what you said, you might have to pass your child off to somebody else, or you might have to go to another adult, and that other adult will have some influence. If you are not great at building relationships, well, start today to practice. Tell the stories to your kids about how you acquired some friendships. Maybe I should pause right here and tell you the reason why this is in this collection of the first six that we're going to look at. I've done a lot of reading over the years, and one of the things that I've noticed is that people who end up being influential, a lot of them describe how in their homes in the formative years, in other words, their mom and dad's home, that formative environment, the parents had friends over regularly. And it wasn't the friends where they just had a 5-minute chit-chat. They would build their week around a Friday evening or a Saturday evening or a Sunday evening. When they would have some good friends over, there'd be some simple meal or something, or maybe there'd just be something like that. But they didn't just eat together and then go home. They had long conversations about wide-ranging topics. They'd talk politics, they'd talk environment, they'd talk people, they'd talk big concepts and ideas. And the kids, later on, years later on, some of them in their 50s and their 60s, when they finally sit down to write something that we might want to call their memoirs, describe in detail how they remember sitting there as kids and they weren't shooed out of the room to go do something else. They were given some toys to play with. And in a couple of occasions, these children, now adults, describe over a period of time, we just stopped playing with the toys and started to listen to the conversations. And then, one of us, I remember, and then this is one child talking about he and all of his siblings, said, I made the bold move of offering to inject my opinion into the adult conversation. And the adults welcomed it. And what the children are learning is, I can have an influence in adult affairs. I am actually going to be part of a community. Now, most of us tend to do things differently. We tend to just isolate around a television, or we have quick conversations and we're on our way. Understand this, if you want to have relational children, you have to develop a relational environment somewhere. I don't know exactly where you do that. That's why you are in charge of your family and not me. You have to figure a way, if you want your children to excel at relationships, to build your home in a way that relationships can be central in it. While we're on that topic, and it's going to be a little bit out of order here, but I want to say this. Know the broken part about relationships that we talked about? How many of you have had any conflict in the last week? Okay? You're just rolling your eyes at me. I'm not sure what that means. And over the top of your glasses, too. There's usually a meaning to that. Okay. How many of you would say that conflict is a somewhat regular part of your everyday life? Not severe conflict. I don't mean pots and pans flying across the room or copy machines kicked or whatever it is that you do at your office when things are hammers slung across the job site. But just more somewhat civilized conflict. Okay? How many of you in the past month could identify someone whom you say, this person does not do conflict well? As a matter of fact, when I say, does not do conflict well, are there faces that you can just picture? It's like when you hear that phrase, that person comes to mind. Are you rolling your eyes again? No. Oh, he's taking his glasses off. So
imitating her.
Oh. I have a question for you. Where do people learn how to do conflict? Yes, they do. Your home environment is the breeding ground from which will arise the way in which your adult sons and daughters manage conflict, because it is the first laboratory in which they experience it. What do you think are some of the ways that we manage conflict? Okay, that's one. You're upset, and everybody knows you're upset. So screaming is certainly one way.
Silence,
that's another way.
Keep quiet, baby.
What happens when we're silent, when we disagree? Obviously, this is the most participation yet. All right, I've got to tame the lions here, so we'll get to you first. I got the chair over here to back the lions off there. So, what do you want to say?
You prolong the argument.
You do, don't you? What else?
Builds up inside.
Oh, it does, doesn't it?
And then eventually, if another argument happens, you bring up that situation from months prior.
Yeah, exactly. And so the person is really ambushed, right? He or she thought you were talking about the crappy meal that was in front of you, and it turns out it's about the laundry that wasn't done 6 months ago, about the checking account that's overdrawn, and the thousand other things have been building up and building up and building up. Now, when you have that expression of your dissatisfaction, we'll just call it that, when you have that, is it generally helpful to the other person the way in which you express yourself? Does it give them guidance and clues as to how they might do things differently in the future? No, it usually doesn't, does it? So by that time, by the time we have let it build up and build up and build up and vented, it really has nothing to do with resolving the conflict and everything to do with finally making ourselves feel good and the other person know what an inferior piece of scum they really are. Well,
No.
What do you think? You're the only one that can look over the top of your glasses and roll their eyes, or what?
Are you one of our eyes?
So let me suggest to you that as much as kids will learn how to relate well and how to build relationships, they desperately need to learn how to do conflict well. So even if you don't want to do conflict well in your home for your sake and the sake of your spouse, learn how to do conflict well for the sake of your kids. Oh, I'm sure it does. Go on.
That's what you're saying. It's kind of scary because if they see the parents arguing and fighting, that's nurturing them, or what's the word? And instilled in their heads of how to handle things in the future. That's
the way they're going to be when they
exactly.
It is absolutely the way that they're usually going to be. There's one of two things that generally happens. They will just assume that this is the way other people have done it. Okay. So imagine we're in a room of all white people right now. So imagine that you grew up among white people, never saw a book in your life, and all of a sudden one day you see a black person. That's exactly the way it is with people who have assumed that there is one way that conflict is done. And they leave home and they go into other relationships and they find out that not all conflict is done that way. Or you'll hear from Johnny's teacher, right? About how Johnny was having a conflict with somebody else on the playground. And it turns out that Johnny uses the exact same words when he's having a conflict with one of his friends as you did when you were having a conflict with your wife just the other night. Only those words aren't acceptable for Johnny on the playground when he's in fourth grade.
for it.
Now, maybe that was an extreme case, but maybe it wasn't.
It also makes it hard when you have a stepdaughter, and the way her father is just so wrong, you can't begin to tell how wrong he is towards his children. And you're trying to set a good example and teach them the right thing, but every time it's, oh my gosh, that's hard.
And I think another way, we talk about silence and screaming, I think another way, a bad way of sometimes we can handle conflict is avoiding it. Because I know, for my personality, like, I hate going into a conflict situation or bringing something up, so I'll be like, they'll change, and then they don't change, and you're like, okay, now it's time to, you have to step up and go in there.
But yeah, you gotta resolve it. If you do walk away, I've been taught that, to walk away, count to 10, but sometimes that festers on the other side, says,
so all right, you walk away with a string.
You walk away, walk away, it doesn't
go away.
Well, that's like the old saying, you know, you take the rat poison, but you're hoping the other person's going to die.
Yeah, right.
If you're always told that in a manipulative way that you're wrong, no matter what, you get tired of saying the same old thing. I'm right.
Is it not healthy to at least have, even right now, apart from the conflict, isn't it healthy to have conversations about the reality of the conflict and understand, number one, you're not the only one, that everyone has these conflicts of one sort or another, and that we need to have better ways of doing it. And let's make it infinitely more amazingly practical. Would you agree that in general the world doesn't know how to do conflict well? Would you agree that you could turn on the news on any given night and find out that the world does not know how to do conflict well? So, clearly, we as a species have some work to do in this area.
And you brought up a good point beforehand when you said that we need to learn how to handle the conflict. Just knowing that there is conflict and knowing that there's different ways of handling it, and how we ourselves, in order to learn how to handle conflict, must understand how we ourselves handle the conflict. And then take it outside of ourselves and say, how does this person handle conflict? And then we need to learn how to handle how they handle conflict.
There's too much going on there. I'm in the other room already.
And that's why we need to take the responsibility on ourselves, especially if we are supposed to be leading our families. We need to set in every example what we are doing and taking the time, looking into it more, studying it, finding where we can find those resources to handle that kind of conflict. Because your way of handling conflict isn't going to be the same way that your spouse or your children or your parents handle conflict.
Okay. So just to maybe say what he said in a different way and about more things than this. When it comes to relationship skills, they are skills. It's more than just warm and fuzzies. And most of us assume, well, let me roll the tape back. Did you just assume that you and your mate would get along when you got married?
Yes.
Did you just make that assumption?
No.
I think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people assume that they're just going to get along with somebody else because this is the one person. And you see some of their good sides or good spots or whatever, and you assume, well, they couldn't have this other evil demonic streak that lives within them.
Yeah, but at that point in time, you don't have the pressures of life.
No, you don't. That's right.
You don't have the job. You don't have the children. You don't have the boss. You don't have the mortgage.
Scars.
Yeah, you don't have those pressures weighing on the relationship. So everything's hunky-dory. You know, you've got your time. Mm-hmm. You've got your choices. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of agreement there in those choices. So to, you know, see in the future the conflict, it's blind to a young person. So I think probably most importantly, you know, because you learn this 20, 30 years later, is how to forgive. I mean, you could have that knocking down, dragging out battle in front of the children, but the children need to see the forgiveness.
Yep.
They need to see the repair of the conflict.
And every household is different, but you can understand how this is not intentionally dealt with and managed. And this is why in the queue that already has 10 or 15 other things you haven't talked with your wife or your significant other about, you need to add this to that queue of things you need to have a conversation about and help that person to understand, yeah, we're going to have some conflicts. Our kids are going to absorb these. So maybe we need to consider different and better ways for us to have conflict. Okay, moving on. Relationships are about knowledge and skill. It's just that simple. And a lot of young people figure out that they're just going to figure it out as they go along. Oh, we've got love, so we can overcome everything else. Really? Talk to the person who's been married just 2 or 3 years and see if love overcomes everything. There's a list as long as this ceiling is tall of the things that love itself just doesn't overcome. Right? Enough said. And so as much as this, and Jason has said it already, this is work. It really is work. You need to make a personal commitment to invest in the knowledge, because knowledge is awareness. Abstract knowledge doesn't do you any good, but knowledge is a new form of awareness, and the awareness not only applies to you, but it applies to other people. So, is it on the first page? Yeah, it is. Okay. It's probably on your first page. It's the second quote down. It says, even in the best of relationships, we get frustrated with each other. We hurt each other accidentally and on occasion on purpose. Our ability to sort out how we're feeling, why we're upset, where we are bumping into another, these drive the long-term health and happiness of those relationships. And this book, thanks for the feedback. If you're a reader, I'd strongly recommend you buy it. And no, it's not one of these books that has Jesus in every other sentence. It is an infinitely practical book. It is written by a couple of people who specialize in business-related feedback, and it really addresses some issues in a profound way. I've gotten stuck on pages in one chapter or another and just spent a half an hour stuck on just one page and considering it. It's really good stuff. All right, moving on. Again, you don't have this as a heading, but it's buried in there somewhere. What's the relational cost of a transaction with you? And just stop there. What is the relational cost of a transaction with you? Okay, so imagine you go to the store in the morning. You got $10 in your pocket. You give the cashier $2 for, I don't know, a pack of gum or something like that. You get some change back. You got gum. They got some money. It's an even transaction. Now imagine that every time someone has an interaction with you, there's a transactional cost. When two people leave their transactional interaction with each other, they've got some assumptions and some feelings about what just happened. Do they feel as if they got too much change back? They gave you a 10 and they got a 20 back from being with you? Or do they feel like they gave you a $10 bill for a pack of gum and they got nothing back? And just ask yourself that in every interaction that you have with other people. Have they left feeling that they got the better side of things? And incidentally, that doesn't mean that you got cheated. See, in an ideal transaction, both people leave that relational transaction feeling that they've gotten the great end of the deal from that. Whether it's simply your upbeat personality, and maybe it is a cashier, and they not only got to sell you the pack of gum that they really didn't care about and they weren't going to get any of the profit from, and they feel like an abused worker who's working for the man and never going to escape, and you know the routine, but did you brighten their day? And in that sense, they're glad for that transaction. Or did they not only have to deal with you and the stupid pack of gum that you wanted, but did they have to deal with a grumpy you? A cranky you, a demanding you, because that store didn't stock the particular brand of gum that you wanted. And incidentally, our kids see this. One of the things that I hate about my younger adult son is that he is annoyingly attuned to how annoying I am. I mean, he is like really annoyingly attuned. I'm not a basket full of peaches to deal with every day. I know that. But he is aware of that. And he feels like it is his singular, purposeful mission in life to point these things out to me. at all cost, at all pain to himself. Just say.
Let me did just something similar to what you're explaining.
You mean you're cranky and irritable too?
Well, no.
No.
How do you leave somebody feeling better than they did, or just being a third party observing the relationship between other people? I was at a football game a couple weeks ago. I'm in the stands, and I'm sitting 2 seats from the aisle where people walk up and down the bleachers. And the gentleman in front of me finds $80 on a step. And he turns back and said, to my wife, did you drop some money? She says, no. He said, I found $80 on the step. My wife says, I think it's that kid down there. He just walked by. So he went down, asked the kid if he lost money. He said, no. He asked a few people, no. This one kid, he's in his late teens, early 20s maybe, comes up. And he's looking around. And the guy says, did you lose some money? He says, yeah, I lost it when I got my phone out of my wallet. And he says, yeah, it was like $80. And he says, here's your money. And the kid was really happy, obviously, that he got his money back. But I think more importantly was the people that observed the interaction and heard the conversations, and there may have only been a few in that area, I think it sent a silent message to them that, hey, there's the right thing to do. Seek out the right thing to do, and good things come back to you. And I think it's really important how you interact with not only people directly, but indirectly with the people that observe you.
The thing is, you can't take it. One of my mentors that I listen to, his name is Jeff Combs, and he said, you be outgoing, you're friendly to people, and if they're not friendly back, he said, you can't take it personal. He said, they're just what we call unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the waitress that comes up to you in the diner and says, you want more coffee? No, thank you. She's not taking it personal. She just goes to the next table. And I think once we get over that, this guy's a grouch. Okay, he's a grouch. Ain't my problem.
Mm-hmm.
I try to be nice, manners, everything. They're unavailable. They're just not available, and you just got to walk away. I mean, you can't let it start burning at you.
Learning by doing too. At your point, if there's a child or an adolescent in that, and they see that, like you said, they view that, and it makes them, and they think next time it happens, then they do it. That feel good. That makes them do it. And learning by doing it. I was on the road with my son the other day. We stopped to help a person on the side of the road. He's like, "Why did we do that?" I'm like, "It's a nice thing to do." And he's like, "Oh." So learning by doing, not just listening, but actually doing the actual act, makes them instill. Because like you said, people learn differently. So it's not listening, but doing it.
Yeah, and understand, sometimes we see our kids through adult minds and think, well, they should know that's a nice thing to do or the right thing to do. Well, you know what? If they've never, and we'll use just the flat tire, if they've never been dressed in their business best on the side of the road with a flat tire and 15 minutes to go till their next appointment, they don't have that body of knowledge of reference to be able to say, oh, it really is a nice thing when somebody comes and helps you with the right. So we can't assume that our kids should grasp things from an adult perspective because they haven't had 20 or 30 years of adult exposure to understand and feel all those things. So some things that we just take for granted and feel naturally, they haven't ever had a chance to feel them yet. Okay. So we're going to move along. We've covered the basics of that. Do you see how much there is to learn here? And so you need to, when you leave here, I hope one of the promises you're going to make to yourself is you're going to begin to learn more about intentionally being good at relationships and start to pass that on to your kids. Okay, here's an unlock a secret thing. No person who feels bad about themselves is going to be good at human relationships. Why? In other words, if you have no sense of personal worth, dignity, and substance, you are going to be bad at interpersonal relationships. Why?
You have to love yourself before you can love others.
Yes. And that's the first part.
You have to see yourself in a positive, it's having that positive self-esteem
that you can share with other people, because if you don't have that for yourself, you can't possibly share it with someone else.
Suppose you walk up to the counter, you put the gum down on the counter, you reach in your pocket and there's nothing there. That's exactly the condition that a person with low self-worth finds in every relationship that they enter. They want the transaction to take place, but they don't feel that they have anything to offer in the transaction, and so they tend to keep to themselves. So here's a list, and I'm pretty sure you have this list, although it might not be organized quite as well as I have it on my personal notes here. Sorry, Scott.
Why do you refer to my notes?
Because I'd like to be able to have this make sense when I'm done here. Okay. People who are not secure in and who they are will often avoid deep and meaningful or revealing relationships. Especially revealing relationships. Now, we're going to get into this a little bit more in just a minute. But why does the person who has no sense of identity and no sense of worth not want to have a deep relationship? Because they're afraid that when the person gets beyond your superficial facade, they're going to find out there's nothing there. So you don't ever give them a chance. The next thing that they'll do, they'll act like a thief in a relationship. So instead of walking up to the cashier, placing your $10 bill down and getting the pack of gum, they try to steal the pack of gum. They try to get something from you without having to have the real interaction and transaction. Because at a base level, we all know we need things from other people. You can't go through life. Remember our organizing principle. Almost everything that you do in life, you will do either for or with other people. That means you're not going to do much in life that doesn't involve other people. So if you think you don't have anything to bring to the transaction, but you still need other people, what are you going to do? You're going to try to manipulate, connive, and in some way twist from the other person what you need, all the while feeling unworthy to give anything back. Okay, here's another one. They project a brash and arrogant spirit to conceal the nothingness that they feel inside. Right? They still need something. So they got to be a poser. So they become a brash poser. I'm not going to ask you if you know people like this. We all do. And so our first response is to think, geez, they just need an attitude adjustment. Well, no, maybe they need more than that. Maybe they don't have much in the way going on from the inside anyway. Okay, and the final thing, they'll destroy other people in an attempt to bring them down. So if I'd have nothing to bring to the transaction, what do? I say, I argue for the fact that that gum is worth nothing. Why should I have to pay for it? It isn't very good gum anyway. Okay, it's a bad illustration. Just work with me. No, don't take the gum illustration out into the marketplace and use it. But, well, maybe it is. I don't know.
What flavor is the gum?
Juicy fruit. You ruined the whole illustration. Do they even sell that anymore?
I don't know.
Great illustration.
All right. So three strategies for every person developing some good relationships. You got to build up personal confidence. Do you see the role that you play as a parent there? Kids are going to derive a lot of their self-worth from how you assign worth to them. So if you're not building your kids up in the home, and incidentally, this gets back to, do you have a place and a purpose in this world? Are you assigned a place and a purpose by God, or is it just random luck that you are where you are and what you are, and you've got to grasp for everything yourself? Because if you are nothing but the luck of the gene pool and nothing more, and we're all genetic products, but if you are nothing but the luck of the gene pool, then some of us probably feel disadvantaged and some of us feel advantaged today, right? Because we all can look around at people in society and we can say, boy, if the gene pool is all there is to life, that person didn't do very well. They shouldn't go to the casino because it doesn't look like they do well in things of luck. And other people, they would be very lucky. So, do you see how detrimental a naturalistic worldview, I hate to lapse back into this, but do you see how detrimental a naturalistic worldview is to self-worth? If I don't have a belief that there is a God who has a place and a purpose for me, carved out specifically for me, and something that I can do, then all of my worth is only a matter of what I can make of it. And if I haven't been given the right genetic advantages, if I wasn't born in the right situation, then I'm not worth much. But you, as parents, have a great opportunity, or even grandparents, to build up your kids. All right, the next thing that you do, the next component of relationships is you have to assume the same of other people. In other words, annoying Mike over there. Irritable, annoying Mike. I have to assume the best about him, even on those days when he's... Because why? Because in the same way that God has afforded me a place and a purpose in this scheme of things, he's done the same for Mike, and therefore I have to treat him as a person of dignity and worth. So that's the next thing. You teach your children, you personally, you are a creature of worth and dignity. Every other person is a person of worth and dignity. How would that change your transactions throughout the day if before you had every relational transaction, you reminded yourself that that other person is a person of worth and dignity? Yes, that means the person who just flipped you the second finger salute when they drove by you and cut you off on the road. That even that person has a place and a purpose with dignity. I know that's hard to believe. And then the third thing is, now think about the excitement potential here. If every one of us is people with worth and dignity, and every other person on the planet is a person with worth and dignity, and yet no two of us are the same, then every human interaction and every human relationship is an opportunity for one person with unique gifting and worth to get to know something more about another person with unique gifting and worth. I can't even say that right, but you know what I'm saying. All right, so some of the values of human relationships. I got to move on. I do have Scott's notes. Let me see if I can help you to find where this is.
He went to Lehigh, doesn't
he? So are you saying he doesn't have any dignity or self-worth? Or you just haven't found any? You know, I think the transactional cost of that was just too high for Scott. He's probably going to tell you to keep your gum.
That's right.
All right, I can't find it on Scott's outline, which is my outline, just not formatted the same way as my other outline is. All right, the value of human relationships. Here's the first one. This is huge. I'd like you to imagine that you are in a dark room and none of your senses work. Literally, none. You can't touch, you can't hear, you can't see. I don't know why you would want to taste anything in the dark room, so we'll leave that out. How do you know where you are? He's not paying any attention. How do you know where you are? You don't, do you? Human relationships help to orient us. This is huge. Human relationships help us to understand if the idea that's going through our head is crazy or if it's got some credibility. Human relationships orient us to the extent that when we get angry and we think, doesn't anybody else get angry at this? Human relationships validate whether it's something worth getting angry about in a context. And so while we have to have some sense of personal dignity and worth, character and value, in other words, we have to be able to draw our own conclusions, have you ever drawn a strong conclusion about something only to find out later that you were wrong?
I hate that.
And you remember the one and only time that it ever did, right?
I thought it was wrong.
Yeah, I know. Do you have people in your life, and are you helping your children to have people in their lives whose reference and orientation perspective can help and guide them? Now, incidentally, this can be critically important in teaching them the value of selecting relationships carefully. We're going to see this in a moment, but maybe I may as well introduce the other idea. The other idea is that I have to afford trust to other people. So here's the way this human relationship thing works. So here's John and I. When we have transactional relationships and nothing but transactional relationships, there's a barrier between us. I step outside my barrier for a moment. I hand him the $10 bill. He gives me change for my $10 bill. I go my way. He goes his way. The deeper relationships go, the more that I open myself up, pull the facade down, and now, in essence, what happens is I have given John part of my spirit and John has given me part of his spirit. And we each carry part of the other person around. This is especially true in very intimate relationships. Parent-child, husband-wife, we carry part of the other person around with us. This is why trust is so important. What happens when I do something that violates the other person's trust?
Things start going sour.
Right. I pull back immediately. I take all of that relationally shared ground and I pull it back.
And sometimes, I mean, it takes time. It's like if I was working at Wawa and you came in every day for your black cup of coffee, which I know that you drink, and, you know, it's how you doing, then all of a sudden, hey, but yeah, well, you know what, I see you in here all the time, what's your name? And the next thing you know, you're on a first name basis. Mm-hmm. Maybe you start talking about the Eagles or the Phillies.
No, not me.
See, I ruined that. Now I got to pull back.
I violated trust already, see?
But I think the example was set.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden, hey, Glenn, how's it going? Well, John, how's it going today? Yeah, started at 6 o'clock this morning. Where are you off to? Well, I'm headed to, you know, I'm going out to Ohio today or whatever. And then all of a sudden it's, and then maybe you become friends. And then maybe it's, hey, maybe we'll go for a beer, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll watch the game or something.
Yeah.
But you never, I mean, that's how things start out. But you're right, you have to, it's that trusting. You're not going to violate the other guy's trust.
Okay, now, given what we've just talked about, and that gradually there is a sense of shared real estate in that relationship, do you see how important it is that you pick relationships wisely? All the talk in the Proverbs about choosing the couple of people or the handful of people or maybe the community of people that you interact with is based on the fact that all relationships involve something that is shared. Remember what we said about orientation. So if you are the person in the dark room with no senses and that other person is the means by which you orient and their values are different than yours, what's going to happen? Yeah, the values are going to be changed. And so that's why we help our kids in relationships to understand that there are destructive relationships. Relationship is all about shared belief, shared real estate. So make sure that you're picking carefully. All right. Give me a moment to...
The aspect with relationships, you know, I'm not a parent yet, but my parents always told me, you know, be careful who you associate with when you're kids. So, you know, I don't like the kid that you're hanging out with. He's a bad influence on you. That never changes. As we grow up and become adults and in our relationships as adults, we still have that same influence. If we're still hanging out with the people who were bad influences as kids, how much of a worse influence are they now that we're adults? And we really have to guard those relationships well and make sure that if you keep them, that you're being the positive influence and not receiving that negative influence from them. Because that never goes away because you are who you associate with.
Okay. Excellent. 10 relationship skills to practice regularly and practice with your kids. I don't know if you have a heading like that. You may or may not. It's the only thing with 10 points on it. So let's read through these quickly. How you implement these in your home is up to you. This is the last thing we're going to do because I simply cannot get through anything more this morning. There's other good content here. Take time to read it. All right. Number one, show interest in others and in a broad variety of things. Shared interests improve your relationships. Let me say it in a different way. Don't be a boring klutz, okay? Because the less that you have that you're interested in, the less there is that creates that initial stickiness. So if I didn't like coffee, I wouldn't come into the Wawa and therefore I wouldn't see John. Right? So the fact that I like coffee is and this is a stupid, silly illustration, but you understand what I'm saying. Perhaps I would have more friends if I liked the Eagles. I'm not going to risk that. I'll just do with the friends that I have.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm a Green Bay guy first, but...
Okay, well, you could get thrown out of this community, too, just as quickly, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm being very watchful.
That room's next door.
Okay, the idea of trust. Everything in life is built on trust. How do you relate to people that you don't trust?
No.
You have isolated transactions with them only because it's necessary, which again proves the point that everything that we do in life is either done for or with other people. So we will have transactions with people that we don't trust. Is there any depth of relationship established? No, of course not. So one of the greatest gifts that you can give to somebody else without being foolish is to extend to them a degree of trust. Now, what happens at the other end of the spectrum is the young teen girl. She's 14 or 15. She's in love with this guy. The guy wants to do things that all young guys want to do, and the girl's not sure, but the girl trusts the guy. And then the 15-year-old guy acts like usual 15-year-old guys do, and what happens? So trust has been extended beyond what was deserved, and it's shattering. Okay, so we have to teach our children to extend a limited degree of trust to other people. Have you ever met somebody who's innately suspicious of almost everybody? You can't make any ground. You can't break through anything because there's a constant suspiciousness. Will they have trouble making relationships that are lasting and meaningful? Yes. So we have to help our kids to understand the balance. Okay, number three, this is important. Expect some disappointments or disagreements. Don't have unreasonable expectations. Scott's already talked about number four, seek and offer forgiveness. So, where do kids learn how to forgive? Yeah, again, in the home. That can be a core value in the home. And if they don't experience that in the home, and if kids don't experience that from parents, how are they going to find out what real forgiveness is?
It's also important not to remember, too, the word sorry is used a lot, too. Children, sorry, not to use the word sorry and learn from your mistakes and explain to them why you're sorry. So it's not just a word, just like love. Love's just a word.
That's good. That's very good. Okay, make it enjoyable, fun, and interesting. You know, relationships shouldn't be a chore. At the end of the transaction, I have some gum to enjoy, right? At the end of just a simple transaction. If all of your relationships are serious and pragmatic and there is no fun or joy or happiness in them, then relationships are something that we endure because, why? Because everything that we do in life will be done for with other people, and therefore because that's true, we will have to interact with other people, but we will experience no blessing in it. Wouldn't it suck to go through your whole life and not experience any blessing from other people? All right, number seven, seek commonality for connection and difference for development. You understand what I mean? If you never, and this is something profound to teach your children, if the only people that they hang around with are people that are just like them, they're going to stay just like they are because the only people that they hang around with people are people that are just like them. So we need to discerningly help our children to be exposed to other people. We need to do this. That means that Republicans need to associate with Democrats sometimes, distasteful as that might be for both sides. Eagles fans may need to associate with Green Bay fans.
Hey, don't push it.
As indifferent.
You're right, and you don't learn anything if you don't have a, you really don't learn anything. I listen to debates between Christians and atheists all the time on YouTube, and it's amazing what you learn from the people that just don't believe there's a God. I mean, they're smart, and they've got great insight. But it helps you in on your side to be able to, to take the argument to a higher, and I don't mean fighting argument, I mean the debate argument makes you
to a higher level. Absolutely.
That's exactly right.
Every breakthrough discovery is made not because you hang around with people exactly like you are, but because you hang around with people who are a little different than you are, and the combined fused thinking is better than the either-or thinking that existed before.
It's biblical that iron sharpens iron.
Yep. Which means what? There's sparks fly, there's stuff happens, there's friction that occurs because there's no sharpening that takes place if there isn't that banging. And yet in the end, it's good for us.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for that phrase.
Some of us can look at the person we married and think there's a lot of iron sharpening iron that takes place in the home every day. Some of us, our swords are just plain worn down to nothing. There's nothing left to sharpen because there's been so much iron sharpening iron. We've got a toothpick left. All right. Don't expect too much. This is another important one. Husbands and wives can have this. Every once in a while I talk to a guy and it's like, well, my wife is my best friend. Well, how many other best friends do you have? Really? Really? That's it? You're going to close the door on me? Okay. when you place too much expectation on a relationship, you're bound to be disappointed sooner or later, because we just can't be all things to all people. All right? Give without expectation, finally, and then demonstrate honor. This give without expectation is huge, especially in cultivating friendships. If you go into a transactional arrangement with somebody just hoping to give them something, do you see how important it is to have something in you to give? If you're an empty bucket on the inside, you got nothing to give to begin with. So, again, another thing that you need to teach your children is you need to be putting things into you. You need to be prepared to go out and interact with people for the day, which means you need to have something in you to bring to them. Okay, I promised you that that would be it. It's 9 o'clock.